Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my great friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. For those who don't know Help Musicians, they're a charity that's over 100 years old. They work tirelessly to help struggling musicians to pay their bills, find mental health support, and in the last couple of years, they've been more needed than ever. Over the next hour, I'll be chatting with a man from Manchester who's been in one of Britain's biggest bands. And he's also written songs covered by The Hollies, Cher and The Yardbirds. He's written songs with Kirsty MacColl, he's produced The Ramones and he's toured with Ringo Starr. Please welcome the very wonderful Graham Gouldman. Graham Gouldman, welcome to this podcast. I never thought it would happen, and it's jolly nice to see you. How are you?
I'm very, very well, and delighted to be doing this with you.
That's great. What have you been up to in the most recent weeks?
10cc's going back on the road. We've got a big UK tour coming up. We're doing a rock cruise.
Saga?
Around the Caribbean. Not Saga, no. We're on the boat for 6 days, do 2 gigs, and that should be rather pleasant. And, looking forward to getting back to being on the road and a very busy year ahead, I'm very glad to say, with different things, not only 10cc, but I do another gig called Heartful of Songs, which is like a sort of semi-acoustic gig that I do where I sing songs from my catalogue and talk about them. So that's coming up as well.
That's good. I mentioned Saga because Jules Holland has been telling me about his cruises on Saga and saying how wonderful they are because the audiences are asleep by 9:30.
Yeah, I think, that might happen with ours, I suppose, as well, because I think our audience is of a certain age. However, I think because they're going to be a predominantly American audience, I just think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing. So I can ask you, going back in time now, who was your favourite teacher at school? Was there, most people say there's always one teacher that turns you into the direction that you end up going in.
Well, my favourite teacher was Mr. Pilkington.
Great.
I remember Mr. Pilkington. He was very encouraging. He was the only one that was encouraging. I went to a pretty awful school, North Salford Secondary Modern School for Boys, or for Yobs, as I used to call it. But in a way, the fact that it was not a very good school, I was not very good at school, was to my advantage in so much as when I started getting really interested in music, my parents realised that academically nothing was going to happen. But I had shown this massive interest in music and they were very encouraging of that. Had I have had some sort of something I wanted to do, maybe, I almost said a real job then. But maybe they might have steered me away or maybe wanted me to go to university or something like that, as a lot of my contemporaries were doing. But they realised quite early on that I had a gift for music and encouraged it.
So your parents were obviously musically minded. What sort of music would they play around the house?
Well, it wasn't so much as music, but they were into, I hate the word amateur, but it was amateur dramatics. But my dad was a writer, and that was really what he should have done as a profession. When people say, what did your dad do? I say he was a writer, although he had to have a proper job to earn, some money for us to live. But he wrote plays, he wrote stories, poetry, he wrote for articles for various publications. And of course, most importantly, when I started writing, he was really very, very helpful, not only writing lyrics, but if I wrote a lyric, he would check it and make it better.
That's
so
incredible.
So he was a very important part of my the whole songwriting process for me in the early days.
That's amazing. And did anything happen with these plays?
Well, they won various competitions, but I was always trying to encourage him to write for things like Coronation Street, which we could have done easily, but it wasn't really of interest to him. I mean, a lot of his contemporaries were writing for Coronation Street at that time, But he just wasn't interested in it. And he was, so he wanted to write his own stuff and then started writing with me.
Wow, that's amazing. So would you play him a song or would you just show him the words?
I might play him a song or... So I'll give you an example of something really important. I talked to him about writing a song about being at a bus stop because I used to go to work on the bus every day and we talked about a romance beginning at a bus stop. Mm. And I came home one day and he'd written the first verse. I took the verse, I went into my bedroom and wrote the song. When I saw the words and the way they scanned, I heard the melody. And then the middle of the song, the sort of bridge sections, I wrote in my head the music and the words. So, yeah, very important. Like No Milk Today is his title, and he wrote some of the words to that as well. After visiting one of his friend wasn't in, he turned on the doorstep. He noticed the milk bottle with the note, No Milk Today. And he came back to me and said, I've got a great idea for a song, No Milk Today. I told him it was a crap idea. And he said, but of course, you're missing the point. It's what the milk bottle symbolises. Wow. The fact that that lover's left the house, there's no one there anymore. What a great idea.
Good Lord, that's extraordinary. You really held your hand.
I think it's quite rare that someone working with their dad. So that was great. And I mean, even when we formed 10cc, Kevin used to refer to my dad as, his name was Jaime. He used to call him Jaime the Rhyme. if we got stuck for a word, he was like a walking thesaurus anyway, my dad. You know, we'd give him a call and ask him, what's a better word than this? But like a song title like Art for Art's Sake, he used to say that to me. Although he wasn't a cynical man, not at all, but that Art for Art's Sake, Money for God's Sake, that was kind of amused him. That stuck with me. I liked it as well. And then, of course, we wrote a song with it.
That's incredible. And did he get credited for any of that?
He didn't. He got royalties, though. He was definitely paid, but... there was kind of like a looking back and like a tacit agreement because I was starting off that I should get all the sort of credit for it. But I always talked about him. I never hid it or anything. I was quite proud of him for it. Very proud, actually.
What sort of things would he be listening to that inspired him?
He really listened to music that I listened to. I mean, I remember sitting my mum and dad down to listen to Sergeant Pepper.
Yeah.
And they absolutely loved it. But before that, I mean, there was always music in the house. It was things that were on the Light programme, if you remember that.
I do.
Yeah, so no particular interest in music per se, but more the written word.
That's fantastic to have all of that support. So
yeah.
When you went to your room for Sanctuary and to write, what did that room look like?
What did the room look like? It was just a small bedroom. I remember had very sort of 60s wallpaper.
Mm.
Yeah, it was a single bedded room. We lived in quite a small flat. It was a very nice flat, but it wasn't a big, like a two bedroom flat.
Mm.
There was a small study in it my dad used, and that was it. So it was fairly humble abode, but it was, you know, full of love and encouragement. I used to sit in on some rehearsals. You know, people used to come round and rehearse my dad's plays, and I used to love that. I think I got a bit of showbiz in my blood from that.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Although I'm not really a show-busy person, but I just like the whole idea of people changing character.
That is amazing. And your mother, was she supportive of you too?
Very, very supportive. I always referred to her as my biggest fan.
Aww.
And, you know, God help you if you hadn't heard of 10cc.
Yeah.
You haven't heard of 10cc? Well, I used to have to stop her. I could see her it coming out, but, you know, I just don't say anything. Please don't say anything. but incredible encouragement. And when I started with bands in Manchester in the sort of very, very early days, sort of late 50s, early 60s, my mum would, you know, keep a scrapbook, which I've got.
Mm.
Fantastic scrapbooks. And she was very assiduous in putting everything in there.
That's great. And where did the 10cc come from, the name?
Well, the name comes from Jonathan King, who ran our first record company.
Ah.
That was UK Records, because we were born in the studio, not on the road. So we'd recorded Donna, which was the first single. And Eric knew Jonathan and suggested he might be a good person to put the record out. Anyway, he heard the record, he loved it. He came up to see us and he said, what about a name? We said, we haven't got a name. So he said, well, last night I had a dream that I was standing in front of the Hammersmith Odeon, as was, and on the hoarding it said 10cc, the best band in the world.
Yikes.
And we just said, okay, that'll do. And there was no, I don't remember any sort of discussion about it, or I'm not sure about that.
Yeah, yeah.
We just said, okay.
Isn't that incredible?
But of course, then we found out that the average male ejaculation was 9cc.
Ah.
So we thought that was a much more interesting explanation of the name, of how we got the name.
Brilliant.
So we used that.
Of course, as you get older, it goes down and down and down.
So I've heard.
So tell me what it was like to hear your song being played on the radio for the first time by either the Yardbirds or the Hollies. What was it like?
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Particularly the first song that I wrote that was recorded by another artist, which was For Your Love by the Yardbirds. I remember hearing the... I actually heard an acetate of it, and it completely blew my mind because it was quite different from the sort of demo that I'd sent to them. And they'd added the harpsichord, which wasn't on my version of it. The bongos were, but not the harpsichord. It absolutely blew my mind.
Mm.
I thought it was fantastic. There was also the thing, and you must have had this, if you're kind of walking down the street and someone sort of humming one of your songs, or it's a very strange experience, but it's very nice at the same time.
It's very rare for Squeeze to get covers of songs, so I've never had the glory of hearing like the Yardbirds or the Hollies covering a song that I've written, which is a great shame. But did that inspire you to want to be in a band?
I'd always played in bands prior to that.
Oh,
anyway.
I see.
I think had 10cc not happened, I would be playing in a local band down a pub on Saturday night. I would have to be in a band just to play for my own pleasure. I'm sure I'd still be writing songs as I am now. I sort of was at the right age when the skiffle era started, where we all grabbed any old guitar or any, like to make a bass, you'd have a sort of bit of wood and a bit of string on a box that made a sort of dum-dum-dum-dum sound.
Yeah.
No note, just the dum-dum sound.
Mm.
And a washboard and stuff like that. So I think that period was very inspiring for us all to, you know, have a go, really. Whether we could play or not was another matter.
But it didn't matter, did it, really? Because as long as you had the inspiration and the verve to get up on stage, that was half the joy, I would have thought.
Yeah, and also then discovering the joy of playing with other people.
Yes, of course. And were you doing cover songs or were you doing a bit of both?
No, there were just lots of cover songs with the Skiffle Band was kind of at school. I think we got together, I think there were four of us, because they were going to have some sort of, I don't know, it wasn't a talent contest, but some sort of school concert.
Mm.
And different people got up and played. And, you know, some people played the piano, but I think we were the only skiffle group. But then I got a real taste for it and then was in groups during my early teens for the rest of my life.
Absolutely. And there's a chemistry, there's a sort of arc of being in a band, I guess. Do you feel that?
What way? I don't quite know.
Well,
what you mean.
You know, I think most bands, when they meet at the very beginning, they all have a sort of, they all go in the same direction together. And then after a while, things are a little bit more confusing and people go in different directions and everybody brings different things to the table.
Yes, that's true. I mean, that did happen with 10cc. Mm. You know, there were splits and big splits and small splits and coming togethers and falling apart again. It's hard to avoid it in a way. There's not that many bands. I mean, I can think of the Stones and U2 just come to mind, of bands that have stayed together for quite a long time. Coldplay, maybe as well. Sometimes it's, you have to accept that your flame burnt very brightly for a short time.
Yeah, and it's a shared flame.
It's a shared flame, and it's a shame about that flame, a real shame.
So let's say you've got a song covered by the Yardbirds. Do you get to meet the band
I did eventually. I think they were doing a TV. In fact, actually, they did a TV show when Top of the Pops first started. Mm. It used to come from a converted church in Dickinson Road in Manchester. And at that time, they were on the show. And I was with a band called The Mockingbirds. And Kevin Godley was in that band. And they used to have bands to do the warm-ups for the audience while they were, you know, sorting out the lighting, etc. So we actually got the gig to play on the day that the Yardbirds were actually on Top of the Pops itself. Mm. We were the warm-up band and they were singing my song.
God, amazing.
It was bizarre, yeah.
Did you ever sort of wish that you'd been on Top of the Pops at that stage, or was that something that you were just looking forward to?
I would love to have been on Top of the Pops at that stage. I think I had met them prior to that. I can't remember the circumstances. I was never in the studio with them, but I think I had a meeting with the late George Yagomolsky, their manager, and some of them were around, so I got to meet them then.
How old were you at this stage?
19.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's amazing. It really is. Top of the Pops is was an institution that we all wanted to be part of.
Yes.
I remember being on it quite a few times and having scraps with different people on it. The great thing was you could be on with Peters and Lee or you could be on with Black Sabbath. It didn't matter.
That's right.
Can you remember a sort of time when you were on were on an opposite stage to somebody really bizarre?
I can't remember anything in particular, but of course the charts were very diverse in the 60s and 70s. So you would get things like maybe Lieutenant Pigeon for some reason, about the opposite to 10cc. But then, you know, with the exception of... No, I'm not going to say it. Yes, the charts were very diverse. And so, you know, the acts that were on Top of the Pops would be very, very different to one another. I remember when we first started with 10cc, though, we decided we weren't going to go down the sort of glam rock route that a lot of other bands had taken. And we looked very plain in our sort of denim shirts and jeans, you know, where everyone else was teetering around in very high heels. Some of the women as well.
Yeah. I remember you looking very earnest as a band for a while there, but it was good for the music, I felt.
You know, as I said before, we weren't born on the road. We were born in the studio. So although Eric was probably the one with the most experience, having been with Wayne Fontana and the Mindbenders, and then later the Mindbenders when Wayne left. But when we did our first gig, we got the shock of our lives when people started screaming. We didn't know what was going on at all. We didn't expect it. Mm. So we were all about the music. There was nothing that we were interested in this, in the sort of showbiz side or dressing up or, you know, posing or anything like that. So we were quite bland to look at, I think, but the music for us was what was the important thing.
And it was brilliant too. And let's say, would you come into the studio with a completed song or would it be shared around? Would everybody kick the ball around the pitch?
We might write in the studio. In fact, when we did our first album, there was a rush to get it out and Kevin and Lol would be in one room and Eric and I'd be in another. And we'd say, we finish one, let's hear it, that's great, let's change this, do that, kick it around, then record it. And I absolutely loved that idea. There was an immediacy to things. Mm. We had some really, really good sort of general principles about the songs that we would record. First one was that whoever wrote it, we'd never reject it. The idea being, if you think it's good enough, that's fine. However, I do reserve the right to improve it. You know, I might suggest a different arrangement or let's try these chords here or some kind of melodic overdub that would come into it. So the song was adopted as by the four of us, whoever wrote it. And I thought that was a really healthy and very productive way to be.
That is sharing the flame, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very rare going in the studio today. That doesn't happen at all, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's very rare to go in the studio with other musicians.
It is, isn't it?
As well.
I know, I've just been talking about recording some songs, and when I saw the budget to put a band in a room to record them, I kind of went, no, I can't afford that. We have to do it in the box, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have the technology now, of course, to do that. And it works fine, but there's nothing quite like being together with other musicians and just creating certain stuff there. It's great.
So placing songs, is that something that you still find yourself doing?
It's something that I'm still find myself trying to do.
Right.
It's quite difficult now. When an artist that doesn't write his own songs, like an international artist, say like Tom Jones is not a songwriter, but he sells records and he's obviously internationally known. If he's making a new record, you know, every songwriter in the world is going to be submitting songs to him.
Mm.
And that happens quite a lot. I've got some songs now that I've written or co-written with some artists, so whether they'll happen or not, we don't know. But I don't hold my breath on it.
No. So was it easier then to knock on the Hollies' door and say, look, I've got this song? Who would you have approached?
Yes, either the publishers were very, very active in those days in placing songs. I mean, that's their job now, but rather than just being sort of collecting agencies.
Mm.
The great thing was once you'd started off with a relationship, like with the Yardbirds or the Hollies, say, then, you know, that whole world is open to you.
Mm. And do you still own all of your songs?
Well, they're published by different various companies that have been sold on. But yes, I still get royalties on stuff.
That's amazing, because a lot of people didn't, of course.
Well, having said that, there were certain deals that were done that I wish they hadn't have been done. But like a lot of artists, we tend to want to just concentrate on our art rather than the business side of things. And I wish some things had been done better. However, there's no point in worrying about it. Let me put it this way, I can't complain.
No, absolutely. I feel exactly the same way. We were strapped when we were kids, but you know, we lost 50% of our songs for the rest of our lives. But without signing that deal, I wouldn't be sitting in this shed today in some ways.
Correct. That's right. And if you're happy with your life, you know, I'm very, very happy with my life and my work, even though it's changed a lot because of, you know, age and everything else.
Mm.
But if you're in a good place now, well, then it's all worth it.
Alongside my guests in each episode, we also like to feature the story of a musician who has benefited from Help Musicians and whose career has been supported or even saved by the charity.
Hi, my name is Matthew Hickman. I go under the artist name of Brown Bear, so I'm a performer and I'm a songwriter. That's what I've been doing for, the last 8 years or so now. Brown Bear is very much seen as a band. We're in the kind of indie rock genre, so there's a lot of influences from my upbringing. I'm actually mixed race, so my mum's black and my dad's white. You know, like my dad was very much Queen and Led Zeppelin and rock, and my mum loved like soul and all the Motown stuff, you know, Marvin Gaye to Smokey Robinson, James Brown. And then when I was growing up and you were hearing a lot of Michael Jackson, and obviously the more I looked into it, I became obsessed with Stevie Wonder. And then that it started with my parents, but became a lifelong obsession. It's so hard to pinpoint the pinnacle moment of your career, but I think for me, there's two sides. Having grown up obsessed with vinyl and CD and listening, I think releasing that first record and seeing my album as a physical thing and being able to hold it, I think there was a real sense of pride, and I was really overwhelmed in that moment. So I suppose being able to have released something that was mine, I think was a huge moment. And then on the live performance side of things, when I was younger, I saved up my money, and one of the first shows I went down on a bus when I was like 17, I think, to Hyde Park, and I saw Stevie Wonder of all people playing. And I remember standing there saying, like, I want to play here one day. I'm going to do this. And I think I was maybe 22 or 3, and we played Hyde Park, playing somewhere iconic and doing that thing that you always think will never happen, because it felt like I'd achieved a real goal or a dream that I'd always had as a young person in music. Help Musicians had done a lot online to spread the fact that they were doing bursaries to help people pay even their rent or for food, for shopping and all those things, which was mind-blowing, that the level of care that they had towards artists, because they're making us human and they're understanding that we're individuals with individual struggles. And out of all the kind of industry, probably put the most time and effort into making sure they reached as many artists as they could. People may or may not know who are listening, help musicians and their funding, offer mentorship and business advice. So learning all of these things and taking them on, as daunting and scary as they are, and it is a lot, I think ultimately is a good thing. And, you know, I actually think the prospect of artists understanding the business and looking after the business is more terrifying to labels than it is to artists, and it leaves less room for exploitation in deals that exist right now that are part of the issue. One thing for me, when we lost live music as a result of the pandemic, we really should have fought for a campaign that really talked about bringing back physical music, because that would have been a way to help support and maybe bring money back for artists, whereas everyone went out and streamed, but that doesn't create revenue really. When you compare music as an art form to, say, film, like, there's still a lot more value in the art. Music's lost a lot of its value because of things like streaming. I do think that we'd be in a much stronger position because we bring worth back to music, and right now music actually kind of sits, in the song in particular, sits without worth, whereas that should be the most worthwhile thing, because without songs there isn't a business, right?
To discover more about the amazing work that Help Musicians do, then look out for them on all social media platforms or go to their website at helpmusicians.org. Do you still have anything from your childhood days that you have around your house?
When you say childhood days, you mean like an electric train set or something like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've got this little lorry, for instance, right, which I had as a little boy. And right, then when I became a teenager, I used it as, I put my cigarettes out in it. But now I just keep it on my desk as a sort of way of reminding me how simple life was.
Yes, that's lovely. The only thing I've got is a little book. It's called Sleepy Time Tales. And it's so non-PC when you look at it now. I'm not going to go into how it refers to people of different ethnicities, let's put it that way. It's very, very sweet, but it would never be published today. I think actually my grandparents bought it for me. But that's the only thing I've got, I think.
Are you fond of touring? I know some people just see it as a bit of a pain in the arse that they have to do just to get the songs across.
I wouldn't do it if it was a pain in the arse, for several reasons. First of all, I don't really have to do it. I really love it. The only part of it that's tiring is, you know, the travelling side of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes pre-tour, you know, you must have done this, you do lots of interviews, like quarter of an hour interviews with local radio stations, which is part of the game. Mm. I'm not complaining about it. It does get a bit wearing when you've answered the same question 8 times in one day.
Mm.
But it's just part of the job, if you like. But that's the only side of it that I find a bit tiresome. The rest of it, though, the band, the boys that I'm with, two of the boys I've been with since the early 70s. So we're like really good old friends. And the newer guys, Ian and Keith, when I say newer, you know, like 15 years or 10 years, we're really good friends. We've got a lot of respect and love for one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know what it's like on the road. The banter is priceless. It's just like a comedy show. So I really enjoy that side of it. I miss my home and, you know, there's always a bit of a price to pay. We try and get back home when we're on tour, if we're in the UK, as much as possible.
I work with a good friend of mine, Melvin Duffy, who's a pedal steel player.
Oh, yeah.
And I got him into Squeeze and... I remember when I used to tour with him earlier on, there was always tons of jokes.
Yeah.
It's like he would filter all these jokes in that he'd heard with another band that he'd been with. But these days, it seems to me, on the buses, on the tour buses in America, for instance, people go straight to their phone and you don't get the jokes anymore. And, you know, I almost want to put a sign up. OK, put your phone down, tell us a joke.
That's right. I think one thing I noticed that happened with us, because we did a European tour towards the end of last year, we were in Europe for 3 weeks, is everyone gets on in the vehicle, you know, and we're chatting away and the banter's going. And then sort of maybe after about half an hour, it all settles down and now we're all watching our Netflix or whatever it is. But the start of it is always heavy banter. And it's brilliant. I love it. It's some of the funniest things I've heard. I wish I could remember them all. It would have been great to record it, but then if we knew we were recording it, it would inhibit us, of course.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I just remember, you know, sitting in the dressing room looking at a bowl of fruit for like 5 hours, waiting for somebody to tell me a joke, and then I turn around and everybody's looking at Netflix.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah, that's the way of it today.
Yeah. So the secret chemistry of being in a band really is banter, and it's about being able to share experiences.
It really is. It really is. And it shows how close you are the more you take the mickey out of one another.
Mm.
And sometimes the banter is absolutely merciless.
Mm.
But the more merciless it is, it shows you love someone more, I always think.
I agree.
Right. But everyone, you know, the guys that I'm working with now are just not only fantastic musicians, but they're lovely, lovely people as well. And that, to me, is as important as someone's musical ability. Mm. Is their... You need to be a team player and no egos allowed. I've had it with all that.
I agree. And I think it's great to go on stage and have that shared peak experience when you're playing a song and the audience are involved. And, you know, you have a contract with people that buy a ticket in a way.
You absolutely do.
They buy a ticket because they want to hear the songs you've written. You can't let them down.
You can't let them down. And the other element is that, of course, because we get on so well within the band, that transmits to the audience. People come up and say, you look like you were having such a good time with one another. You know, I say, well, we were. That's the way of it. People pick up on that. Like they will also pick up on the opposite with if there's a friction in a band. You know, this friction thing,
yeah.
I suppose for some bands, I'm thinking of the Police in particular, maybe that work to their advantage, but I wouldn't have any part of that. I wouldn't like it at all.
Have you toured a lot in America?
Not that much. We did in the early days of 10cc in the sort of early to mid 70s. Never really gained much traction there.
No.
But the last time I toured in America was with Ringo, with the All-Star Band.
How was that?
I did two. That was brilliant. Mm. I did two tours, one tour in America and a European tour as well.
And how does that work? Do you get out and sing a couple of songs and then somebody else sings a couple of songs?
Yeah, well, besides Ringo, there was Greg Bissonnet, who's another drummer, brilliant drummer, Greg Rowley from Santana, Steve Lukather from Toto, and Colin Hay, Men at Work, and myself. So we would all sing three songs of our own, you know, and the rest of the stuff was Ringo stuff. So we'd all be playing on each other's songs, which was great. I loved it.
All right. I was talking to Lulu a couple of weeks ago and she was reminiscing about early tours where she would only do like five songs and then Jerry and the Pacemakers would do five songs and then the Rolling Stones would do five songs. And that would have been an amazing show to see.
Yeah, package tours. I was with the Mindbenders for a very short time. That's really how Eric Stewart and I got friendly, really, doing that. And we did a package tour. I think there was the Small Faces were on, The Who,
wow,
Joe Cocker. I mean, it was incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, incredible.
You wouldn't get that today. No one could afford it.
Nobody could afford it.
No.
Too many dressing rooms.
Yeah.
So in all of your wonderful career, was there ever a point where you just thought, sod this, it's not working for me?
You mean music is not working for me?
Well,
or making music or writing or being in a band?
Well, if I can explain it, I suppose there was a point in my life where I just thought, you know, I don't think this is for me. I don't think I've got the confidence to do it properly anymore.
I've never had that. Even though I've done different things and worked with many different people, and it's been, I just find there's so much, basically what I was put on this earth to do. That's how I feel. And I can't do anything else anyway. I'm not good at anything else. I've got no hobbies. So my work life is recording or writing songs or playing.
Mm.
Those are the three things that I go from one to the other. And whichever one I'm doing is the best thing I've ever done.
That's great.
I'm lucky.
Who do you lean on when you need to have a counsel?
Well, a guy I'm working with at the moment, producer called Graham Pleath, who I've worked with for many, many years, and I've done all my recent sort of last decade solo albums with him. He's a very, very good sounding board. You need someone that's, first of all, that whose opinion you respect, and you need someone that's honest.
Mm.
And he is both of those.
But like on an emotional level, would you be able to sit with him and say, I feel pretty down
today? Oh, I see,
today.
Like that. Anything like that, I would talk to Ariella, my yeah. wife. She's a very good, gives good counsel.
Does she?
yeah.
That's very important part of the team, isn't it?
Very important part of the team. To be, encouraged. There's also someone else, actually, our agent, Steve Parker, who we've been with for more years than I care to remember. But he also is very, very good. If there's a business problem or something like that, he's very good to talk to.
Mm. So who have you written for in the last sort of, 20 years or so, where you've thought, oh, that was a lucky break, I've got a song on their album?
Yeah, there's a few people I've been lucky to meet and work with. The late Kirsty MacColl.
Of course.
I worked on her last album. Mm. I had a track that I co-wrote with her and a B-side of one of the singles. And what a tragedy. I mean, her life was going so well when we lost her. Andrew Gold, who I work with, a great loss also. Gary Barlow, I've worked with.
Really?
He was
great to work with. How was that?
It was great. He is a very energetic, lots of ideas. I don't know whether it might be actually slightly more than 20 years ago. I can't remember. But anyway, I worked with him. The funniest one was I worked with McFly. Mm. My eldest son, Louis, is now the president of Island Records. But quite a few years ago, he was an A&R man there. And he was A&R-ing McFly, and it was quite a thing for him to actually put your dad with one of your bands. It sounds a bit mad. I mean, nepotism, no doubt about it. But, of course, he thought it would work, and it did work. And I had a tracker that I co-wrote with them on their an album called Wonderland that did very well.
So, like, passing the baton from your father to you, from you to your son. What an amazing thing.
Yeah, and Louis is probably the one person I have the I get the most nervous about when I playing him in anything new, because I put out a solo album just when the pandemic started. Not very good timing. But I play him stuff like I was playing him stuff from that, and he can be, a quite harsh critic, but... so far, so good. I don't know whether he's gentle with me or what, but I know he's not gentle with other people. But I do like playing stuff to him. He's got a tremendous musical sense of what's working and what's not. Really good.
So is co-writing pretty much an adventure for you still?
I love it.
Yeah?
I do like it, yeah. I mean, I've been to Nashville quite a few times.
Oh, yeah.
And worked with writers there. Not that we're writing country songs, but we're writing kind of... I don't like pop music. The word, the phrase.
I know.
But popular music songs.
Yeah.
I worked with a guy called Gary Burr, Beth Nielsen Chapman, who I know you know.
Yeah.
I've worked with her really successfully. I put an EP out called Play Nicely and Share that she co-wrote a song with me. And the song on my last album, that album's called Modesty Forbids, I co-wrote a song with her and a guy called Gordon Kennedy. We wrote that in Nashville. Yeah, so I do like her writing a lot. And I've also been working with one of the boys in the band, Ian Hornell's a very, very good songwriter.
Wow, that's cool. I remember writing a song with you and Suggs.
Yeah.
It was called Three Bacon Sandwiches.
Yeah, one of the greatest...
songs ever written.
We didn't get an Ivor Novello Award for that, didn't we, for some reason?
I can't see it on the wall here, no.
No. Three bacon sandwiches.
But then Socks, it was difficult to pin him down, let's face it.
I know. But we also wrote another song, There Was a Day.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, which was, I think, like 2000 and something, early 2000.
2002, if maybe then, yeah.
Yes, and that was lovely, really lovely.
Mm.
Lovely song.
Yeah, I haven't done any co-writing for quite a long time, and I did that Nashville thing and was terrified by it. But I think I'm now in a better space to go back and try it again, I think.
Yeah, I've had good experiences and bad experiences there. But I know, like, people like Beth Nielsen Chapman and I have written quite a lot of stuff together, and it always works because the chemistry is good. Of course, that's what it's all about, isn't it? I mean, it's very rarely that I do co-writes and nothing comes out, but it does happen, and that's what I put it down to. It's not that the other writer or, you know, is off or I'm off that day or anything else. Sometimes it just, for some reason, it's a mystery. It just doesn't, you just don't gel with someone. And, you know, you have to accept that that happens. But fortunately, it doesn't happen very often.
Do you write with Kevin at all?
Well, Kevin and I put out, it was an EP called GG06 in 2006. He phoned me up. He said, do you fancy doing some writing together? I said, well, what's the purpose of it? He said, just to do it. I said, OK, that's fair enough. And we wrote six songs together, which were all great, and recorded together. And I loved working with him. We threatened to do it again. He now lives in Dublin, and with the pandemic and everything, of course, nothing's been happening. But I'd definitely work with him again. I mean, the only way I've worked with him other than that is that on the 10cc shows, he's done three videos for us that we show. We have intro music called Son of Man, which describes the formation of 10cc, and he's done a video for that. And then he actually appears on video on stage with us singing Somewhere in Hollywood.
Wow, amazing.
And it's absolutely brilliant. And he's also done a video for When We Do I'm Not in Love.
That's amazing.
So he's there with us, yes.
See, I mean, the reason I asked earlier about America is because MTV would have been playing your music quite a lot, I would have thought.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, we did make videos. I think the major hits that we had was kind of before the MTV era. So, I mean, but songs like Dreadlock Holiday and The Things We Do for Love, I think, would probably have sort of been in there.
Does musical theatre interest you?
Not really. There are a few exceptions, but I have a... I don't want to say a loathing. I'll say a loathing.
You said it.
I've said it. Yeah, I don't like people suddenly bursting into song. But there are exceptions, of course.
Because pop music is now on the West End stage. You know, it doesn't have to be the old shoe shuffle like it used to be.
Right, that's true.
Like, for instance, I've seen Jamie recently a couple of times, and it really is pop music on stage, and it's not shoehorned in. It's just like... it's like an extended video, if you like.
There have been actually proposals to do a musical featuring 10cc songs, but it never seems to have reached fruition. It's not something I'm terribly interested in.
No.
I say that, but I tend to say yes to more things than I say no to. So if someone put the proposal to me, I might well go, well, I'll give it a try anyway. I mean, that's happened to me quite a lot, where I've done something, I think, I'm not quite sure about this, but if it might work, you know, who knows? So I do it, and most of the time it has worked out, but sometimes it hasn't.
I mean, I can imagine taking one of your father's plays, putting music to it and bringing that to the stage.
What a lovely idea that would be.
And including you and him writing songs. I mean, that would be like The Odd Couple in some ways.
Well, I did meet with a West End producer. And the original idea was to do a musical using the music of 10cc. But then when he found out about my relationship with my dad, he was more interested in doing that. And then I heard absolutely nothing. So a lot of things are proposed and don't come to fruition.
Of course, but sometimes you have to chase them, I guess.
Yeah, I guess I didn't have the, I don't know, the wherewithal or the...
Yeah.
You know, I thought the idea was lovely, and we actually started talking to Ariella about who was going to play me. We dismissed... my wife would like Bradley Cooper to play me, but I said that ain't going to work. But I thought of Jeff Goldblum might be quite good.
Very good.
That would... So it was worth it for, you know, to go through that sort of thing. Yeah.
So Help Musicians as a charity was started by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams in 1921. A friend of theirs who was a violinist, his family didn't have enough money to bury him, so they chipped together and started a charity for musicians who were down on their luck.
Yeah.
And in the pandemic, the charity had provided £19.3 million to over 20,000 musicians. amazing thing.
Yes.
It's the only kind of empathy I've witnessed in the music industry. What do you think of the music industry?
Well, first of all, can I say, regarding help musicians, I actually did help musicians. Because of the pandemic and having put a studio in my house, I did an album of instrumental music, with the exception of one instrumental that I wrote myself. All the songs were songs that I loved and thought would convert to instrumentals really nicely. Anyway, the upshot of this is to say that album was called No Words Today, and all the money that it generated goes to Help Musicians charity. People can pay whatever they want, and the money goes to the Help Musicians charity.
That's beautiful.
I think it's very sad that musicians, particularly songwriters, the way that Spotify and those other platforms work, don't do songwriters in particular any favours. It's always been like that, and, you know, I'm not sure what we can do about it. I'm not sort of like politically active in that way at all, but I would certainly support anything that would help other musicians in any way I could.
Tidal, which is one of the streaming services, I don't know if you've heard of that one.
Yes, I have. That's the one Jay-Z started, is that correct?
Yeah, he credits engineers and songwriters on all of the tracks, and also he's now got this thing where he'll make sure that the artist is paid if you're playing that artist more than you would anybody else.
Right, OK. That's good. I'm glad that he's credited the producers and the engineers.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the sort of things that we... One of the reasons why we bought albums, because not only do you get the artwork, but you get the, oh, I wonder who mastered that. Or, you know, there would be those amongst us who would want to know that sort of detail. Or who played drums on that track? Oh, well, there it is. Oh, it's so-and-so. Great.
Yeah. So, you know, the empathy in the music industry is astounding. I mean, they're so wealthy, some of these companies. And, you know, I know there's been some really great people trying to fix the streaming rate so that people get a bit more of the fruit from the tree. But it seems to forever get stuck. So I'm very grateful for people like Help Musicians and PRS and PPL, people who are willing to go down to ground level.
I'm delighted to hear it that that's happening.
Yeah, it's going to be a long march, though.
Okay, well, I would do anything I can, you know, to support that, as I've said.
Yeah, good. Well, Graham, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Always lovely to speak to you, Chris.
And your stories are brilliant. I'd love to see them on stage.
Yes.
I'd buy the ticket and have the ice cream at the half.
Okay, well, let's see if that happens. You'll be the first to know.
Okay. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Chris. All the very best to you.
What a career Graham has had. What a pop star he is. I feel a lot of kinship with him, growing up in awe of the Beatles and then finding my own path in the 1970s. Though, to be honest, unlike Graham, I've never had Jeff Beck playing guitar parts on one of my tracks. There's always time. You can discover how to support Help Musicians, and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. Thank you once again for listening. Please keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.